Hey, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Hey, thanks for being here. Let me say something, which in some ways may be obvious, but it's always good to have evidence for what you suspect. And I think it's become very clear that the newspapers and the media overall, the mainstream media, don't like Mr. Donald Trump. I'm not saying they should like Mr. Trump. I'm just saying they should do their job, which is then to report. Report negative, fine. Just report facts. Report positive, fine. Just report facts. And I am not trying to say that Mr. Trump deserves to be elected or doesn't deserve to be elected. That's not my point with this commentary. It's that more than I've seen in a long time, the mainstream press has felt justified in treating Mr. Trump as an opponent to them. And I find that dangerous, regardless of what you think of Mr. Trump, okay? The role of the press is to help the public learn what they don't know about candidates. They'll never satisfy everybody. But if you noticed, much of the debate, much of the conversation about this election has to do with material that has very little to do with policy and has everything to do with temperament, dress, matters of personal taste, his personal background. And it's shocking. I saw one study last week which said that roughly 1% of our campaign coverage is focusing on issues. The rest is focusing on matters that are generally considered irrelevant to policy. Not totally irrelevant to the vote, but irrelevant to policy. So, for instance, covering Hillary Clinton's email problems is worthwhile news coverage, right? But it's not really relevant to the policies that she holds. It does speak to maybe character. It speaks to competence. There's nothing wrong with covering that story. But to focus on it as though that's the primary issue involved here is nonsense. We want to know what she thinks about Syria, Libya, what she thinks about capital gains taxes, what she thinks about education reform or criminal justice reform. And I would venture to say that most of us don't really know what either candidate believes in a wide variety of issues. So let's flip it from Mrs. Clinton now to Mr. Trump. I've noticed, for instance, that USA Today has decided that, and this is a paper that has in the past tried to stay nonpartisan. They have a long history of trying to remain nonpartisan. But in the 34-year history of USA Today, we now know that they've never taken sides. They've claimed they've never taken sides in a presidential race. But this year, they've decided to alter their approach. And I'm reading here now from USA Today. "We've never seen reason to alter our approach until now. This year, the choice isn't between two capable major party nominees who happen to have significant ideological differences. This year, one of the candidates is, by unanimous consensus of the editorial board, unfit for the presidency." Well, is that something that they're called upon to do? Well, at least it's good to know that they think that, because Teresa Tomei and I were talking the other day. She was telling about a friend of hers at a major metropolitan newspaper who was listening to the editors there admit during a meeting on election coverage that they feel absolutely no professional journalistic obligation to cover Donald Trump fairly. Now, this is at this friend's publication. They say, look, it's not our problem. It's the Republicans' problem because they failed to put forth a normal candidate. So we can't be expected to provide, you know, normal coverage of a candidate because he's not a normal candidate. So this plays right into the talk I give on media bias. It plays right into what Bernie Goldberg talked about in his book Bias from about 15 years ago. And that is that those who make up the prestige media, these are the major metropolitan papers, CNN, ABC, NBC, Washington Post, New York Times, the so-called prestige media, they're really more insular and parochial than the American people generally. I like to use the example, even though it's an old one, of Pauline Kael from the New Yorker magazine. She was America's premier film critic in 1972. And in 1972, Nixon was elected president. And after the vote, she raged. What? Nixon? Nixon? Who would vote for Nixon? I don't know anybody who votes for Nixon. And I like to point out to my audience, look, do you know somebody who voted for Obama? Do you know somebody who voted for Romney? Do you know somebody who's going to vote for Clinton this year? Do you know somebody who's going to vote for Trump this year? And the answer is, among listeners, yeah, we know people are going to vote for either of them. Well, then you're more cosmopolitan than America's premier film critic was back in 1972. The truth is, those who occupy the prestige media positions in America often go to the same schools, they attend the same parties, they read the same books. They are, in many ways, an insular and parochial community. They rely on one another for promotions, for recommendations, and they live within a framework of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. Mr. Trump is outside the bounds of acceptability. Now, that's not an argument to vote for him. That's just an analysis of the way the mainstream press is looking at the candidates, and that should be part of what's in our mind as we go about consuming the news product here. Ever since 1890, the Arizona Republic has endorsed a Democrat. The Detroit News has been around since around 1873. They've endorsed a non-Republican only three times. But this year, they're not going to endorse a Republican candidate. These are institutions with long memories. They're expecting to be judged by posterity. Maybe they're all making the wrong choice. But the trend is striking. And I think it is affecting the way the reporting is actually being done this year. I do not think that that high wall between editorial and reporting is being respected. The Atlantic has a powerful story, newspapers taking an unprecedented stand against Trump. I'll make sure we have it linked at AveMariaRadio.net today. Or in the Cresta Guest Archives. And then also Teresa Tomeo's column for our SundayVisitor.com. We'll have that posted there as well. There's another story I came across here asking why millennials don't want kids. And this is actually a follow-up to an article that was published. Here are some of the points that are made. Millennials don't want kids because the world kind of sucks now. And so we're afraid to have kids. Or we're poorer as you can get. We don't want to have kids. Or pregnancy is simply not hot. Or we want careers. Or because kids aren't going to fix anything. You know, these are not real profound reasons for not wanting children, but they are revealing. Ever since I became an adult, I've heard people say that the world, I have relatives who have said this, the world's too dangerous a place, I'm afraid to bring children into it. Well, is it as dangerous now as it was in 1945, 1939, 1972? How about this? We can't afford it. Is that true? People stop having children during the Depression? Pregnancy is not hot. That's interesting. Because I've heard just the opposite from married men who really find their wives quite attractive during pregnancy. So many of these reasons that are brought up for not bearing children are as superficial as they sound. They need to be responded to, though, not by argument, but by demonstrating the beauty of family life.